Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, it's how we get there.
Because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go. God bless
you. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is the first Rewind of 2017. Happy New Year, J.R.
Same to you.
And first week of the year means you're swearing in, let's see, 99 assembly members, 16 senators. Yes. So let's just take a look at the assembly. Boy, that's quite a lovely crowd, isn't it there?
Mm-hmm.
99 taking the oath and everything. Okay, the totals, partisanship, 64 R's, 35 D's.
Yep.
Biggest majority since
1957 or 55, one of the two.
1957. Right. Anything said in the first day that surprised you just on the assembly side?
No, I mean, it was an odd comment from Robin Voss, or like out of left field, about medical marijuana.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I mean, it's kind of what we expected. Transportation is going to be the big fight. We all know that. Robin Voss made very clear, the speaker, that if members want to push bills that could be controversial, it's not just about convincing the caucus to support it, it's about getting public support. So this has come up in context of, for example, campus carry, something that Jesse Kramer's talked about before, wanted to see where right now you can carry on campus but not in buildings, right, with concealed carry permits, about allowing that. So what Voss is trying to say is we have to do a better job of selling things to the public. We can't just have this like bubble where we think it's a good idea, and we try and do it. It has to be public buy-in for things. But the medical marijuana thing was an interesting comment. It was kind of asked in context of, he didn't bring it up on his own.
Right.
He was asked about it in context of, well, do you see a difference between that and the opiate problem we have, opioids, you know, being prescribed and then leading to addiction of heroin? Is there a difference? And he said basically, to him, if you have a prescription and a legitimate reason to have it, what's the difference?
Well,
and
there were a lot of eyebrows raised on the part of the Capitol Press Corps when both he and Mr. Steinicke, the majority leader, said, we got the impression, is it a fair impression, that they're open to medical marijuana this
yes,
session?
Yes, but I would not expect a bill anytime soon to get to that caucus. They were kind of more discussing their personal preference. And Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald was surprised to hear the comment as well. We talked to him like hours later and said he's not there at all. So I'm not expecting any big change in that law anytime soon.
Okay, final topic while we're on the assembly. In his speech, Voss made, an appeal for bipartisanship to some of these tough issues. Now, that tone to me seemed a little bit more genuine. We really need you on some of this stuff, Democrats, than some of the past speeches. Is that a fair read or am I overreading?
I don't know. Bipartisanship is an interesting word to define sometimes. Sometimes it's, we're going to do what we want to do. We want you on board when we do it.
Yeah.
So will it be true compromise? That's the question. I mean, if you want to get Democratic votes, do you change a bill to get them or try and win them over? And, you know, with 65 members, they don't need to win over Democrats, right? They don't, or 64?
64.
They don't need to win people over. They've got they can lose 14 members on any bill and still pass it.
Okay.
So what's that going to do? What's bipartisan going to mean in this session?
Okay, same day, same time, different session, different House. You had 16 new senators raising their hands, taking the oath for four-year terms. Now you had four new senators, Republicans David Craig, Dan Fion, Patrick Teston, and one new Democrat, LaTanya Johnson, moving over from the Senate. So 12 senators were reelected in November, six from each party. Republicans will control 20 to 13. What intrigues me about Senate Republicans is at that press conference, Fitzgerald said he didn't rule out taking a job in the Trump administration, right?
He said he couldn't rule it out. So he's had conversations with the transition team, mostly with Ryan Priebus, who's a Wisconsin native, obviously, former state GOP chair, then RNC chair, now chief of staff in waiting for President-elect Trump. So he said it's still a possibility. The vibe about that has been for a while that if Fitzgerald gets something good or something like worthwhile, he would take it. Now, if he gets offered like attaché to some like small bureaucrat.
That's not who he is.
No. But if he gets something that's worth digging his teeth into, then yeah, sure, it's definitely possible he could leave. The question then would be, well, who's going to take over? Leah Vukmir, obviously, as the assistant would be first in line, you'd think.
Even though she wants to run for the U.S. Senate?
Possibly. We'll see if she actually pulls the trigger on that. That's possible.
How do you gauge her interest?
Good question. People are seeing me watching right now what Sean Duffy does first, a congressman from up north.
The one who called Madison communist?
Yes. He was a big Trump
supporter. That's your city. Excuse me.
He's a big Trump supporter to start. So there's a perception, well, he's kind of first in line a little bit.
Yeah.
We've heard names like Dale Kayenga, state lawmaker in the assembly. Eric Hovde, who ran for it in 2012, is interested again, we think.
Right.
So lots of names will float. The question kind of becomes, what's the environment going to be like in 2018? And you'll kind of see that percolating sometime late this summer, early this fall, of an idea of, is the Trump administration going well? Or is there signs of the backlash we saw in 2009 with the Obama administration, where people started getting kind of angry about things? They started seeing that wave start to build a little bit.
Well, we've talked about Senate Republicans. Another one we should mention is Senator Frank Lissay. He's kind of not made any secret about he's open to leaving the Senate for some job that could double his pay. He's now paid 51 as a leggy. I mean, you've heard that.
Sure. There's all kinds of changes could come. What's been interesting about that caucus is going to be how does it operate. We've seen kind of some gradual changing of the guard in that caucus a little bit, and more conservative members being added, like Dave Craig, for example. So you're seeing bolstering this wing that has like Dewey Strobel's, now Dave Craig, Chris Capping as kind of folks who are a little more conservative than people like maybe a Terry Moulton or Jared Petrosky or Luther Olson. So Fitzgerald's management style has been to let the caucus kind of sift and winnow. Mm-hmm. They find their balance, then he kind of steps in and closes the deal. So how's it going to work now with these wings? Are they getting a little bit farther apart? How are they going to work together? And also, I got 20 members. You can lose 3 votes and pass a bill. So how'll that work out too?
Right. And just a note on the Democrats. I had a lobbyist tell me this, JR. I want to run it past you. Senate Democratic Leader Schilling has now said, I will not run for governor mm-hmm. in 2018. Here's the version I got from the lobbyist. Her caucus said, we will reelect you only if you don't run for governor in 2018. Do you believe it?
Be interesting because she, after getting reelected, minor leader, said she was going to think about it. So
yeah.
It'd be
talk
odd.
To her family.
Yeah, talk to her family, but then she shut it down basically a week later to say, you know, I'm focused on this. So, hard to say, but it was clear that you can't be somebody who's trying to rebuild a caucus for the next 2 years and get ready for 2018 to run elections when in seats that are better than numbers for you, by the way, than 2016 seats were, while also running for governor. You can't do both at the same time.
Okay, and just a P.S. on the Senate, one last time. If Mr. Fitzgerald, the majority leader, went off to Washington, that's been a seat that was that's been represented by Republicans for decades.
Red.
And what about the first, Franks?
Fairly Republican, so I assume you'd see a member or two of the Assembly take a look at it. It'd be a free chance to run for it because it'd be a special election. You have to give your Assembly seat, so it could be an interesting one up there about who replaces him, if he were to leave.
I understand. Okay, new subject. Mr. Ryan's first day in office was very interesting.
Yeah.
The night before, he and the Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy said, we really don't think he ought to get rid of the independent ethics panel, but he got outvoted on that. Mm-hmm. That was on a Monday night, and then Tuesday, the day he's going to be sworn in and give the speech and all the kumbaya stuff, the president-elect got in there with a tweet, our tweeter-in-chief.
Now, depending on how you interpret that tweet, was he opposed to the change or just the timing of the change?
Yes, because so he said there are more important priorities.
That's one issue of debate. But what was interesting was that, you know, Ryan's aides and backers are adamant that he was opposed to this from the start. He tried to convince his caucus there was a better way. And they went against him anyway. But then when it became clear, all the pressure coming on, he won them over. Okay, so they're trying to frame it as he fought the good fight. Now, the flip side is if you're a critic of Ryan, you're saying, well, what kind of leader allows this to happen in the first place? Why can't you lead your caucus in the right, you know, the right path from the start? So there's that issue. Are Republicans feeling emboldened because of the bigger majorities, because of the Trump thing? They're going to, like, test out their new majorities and the power and all that kind of stuff. What's going to happen in this caucus going forward? How will it operate? Now, the flip side is Ryan only lost one Republican in the vote for Speaker this time. I think last time in October of, 15, it was lost 8, something like that. So it's very hard to get a unanimous vote in a caucus anymore in the House. He almost did it. So there's that juxtaposed against like the whole thing with the ethics office. Kind of a weird thing.
Yeah, but he ends the week doing this very careful straddle between the president-elect and the intelligence community, which many of Sean Duffy yesterday told, I think it was CNN I was watching, that when it comes when push comes to shove, I trust the intelligence community. Yeah. And that's kind of what Speaker Ryan has said. But Mr. Trump, who's now being briefed on that issue, kind of has gone the other way.
Ask a lot of Republicans about Ryan and Trump, and they will tell you that they are not going to be best buds during this, you know, period of office together. But Paul Ryan sees Donald Trump as the best chance to get a long pent-up agenda passed, and that, yes, there are a lot of things about him that he's not very happy about or doesn't like, but he's going to accept those things to get these big-ticket items done that he's wanted to do for years. I mean, this is an opportunity for him to reshape the corporate tax code, to maybe balance a budget, healthcare.
How many times this week did he say, we have a plan
yes.
to repeal Obamacare?
But when and how is it going to work and what's the plan look like and are the members on board? I mean, there are lots of nitty-gritty to work out yet, but they have, I expect, and people I talk to expect them to be aggressive and moving, rolling on some of these things to get going.
Okay, but this week showed the, as you just said, the real straddle that Speaker Ryan from our first district here has got with the incoming Trump administration. Okay, let's turn to our Capitol. Two things from Governor Scott Walker. Number one, yesterday he called a special session on the heroin epidemic. And one quote he put in that press release, in 2014, Wisconsin saw 843 drug overdoses, 47% of which were caused by prescription painkillers. And we suddenly have a list of what he wants a special session to consider. Let me quickly go through that, JR. Let's ask for $7.6 million in federal dollars. Let's have the UW system charter a recovery school, just three more. $2 million for grants to support new medically assisted treatment centers. $1 million for medical professionals to access addiction medicine specialists. $420,000 per year or $840,000 over the biennium. Four additional criminal investigation agents. And then there's some other things in this package. Talk about why it's significant, why he called a special.
Well, this is a continuation of an effort that was begun by Representative John Nygren a couple of years ago. Nygren has a very personal connection to problems with opioid addiction.
We hope she's still in recovery.
Yes, daughter struggled with this off and on. It's very personal for him. He was the first point of the spear to kind of go in there, okay, how do we deal with this problem? And so the HOPE agenda began. We now have, like, this is like phase two or three.
I think it's at least
somewhere
three.
Around there.
Yes.
So there's a different approach being taken by Republicans right now to kind of this battle with addiction, this problem. How do you approach it? That's interesting. You know, some Democrats have been squawking a little bit kind of under the radar about, well, these guys planted this foundation for this problem years ago with the lock-em-up mentality of the 90s when it came to drugs. Here's what we got now. But that aside, they've got a plan or they're pushing a plan to try and address this and start to pare back. And Nygren, I think this week, talked about the drop in prescriptions for opiate for painkillers. I mean, that's a big way, an entryway to a lot of this stuff, that those are going down. There's more awareness than there was before.
That's a double-digit drop. It's pretty impressive.
So things like that are starting to pop up where they're seeing progress on this problem.
Yeah, and in the first two HOPE packages, nobody voted against this. Mm-mm. You saw Democratic Leader Barkas' statement praising it. Mm-hmm. Even Tammy Baldwin issued a statement.
Talked
I'm so glad Governor Walker is authorizing the state to apply for $7.6 million to
fight
this
problem. Talking about she fought for this money put in there, make available for states. So yeah, they're all trying to work on this, a little bit together. Interesting side note: Leah Vukmir, who you mentioned might run against Baldwin,
yes,
tweeted a little bit of a
system majority leader Vukmir.
Yeah, a little jab at Baldwin about the Toma VA and how she's maybe dropped the ball on that. But that's another side story for another day.
Okay, and now let's preview the governor's state of the state, which has been moved from 7 to 3 p.m. next Tuesday. Mm-hmm. So he's not going to conflict with Governor Obama's goodbye speech to the nation. I think it's going to have three things. He's going to talk about the heroin special session. He's going to take this victory lap on the economy. Our unemployment rate is 4.1%. That's half of what it was when we first took office. We provided more than $4.7 billion in total tax cuts for the hardworking taxpayers. That's theme two. Theme three, is this workforce issue.
And that's going to be a major point of the budget, too, from what we can tell. He's been talking about workforce development for a long time. He will tout often, and Rebecca Clayfish, Lieutenant Governor, often touts the number of jobs available on our state website. I think it's 90-some thousand every
70,
month.
77 strikes.
Whatever it is right now.
Sticks in my mind.
They talk about these jobs are available, and we need people to fill them. And one thing Walker's been talking about has been not just doing job training, but trying to reach people who've been hard to employ, like people get out of prison, people struggling with drug addiction, people limited abilities, that they're trying to find ways to bring them into the workforce.
Yeah.
And part of the stuff he talked to me last month in our end of the year interview about doing heavy duty, quote unquote, welfare reform. The idea behind it being, we want to get people who are on welfare off into the workforce. The way to do it is to wean them off. And what do you do? Well, we now have drug screening and testing for single able-bodied adults, right? No kids. Maybe expand that. He's talking about providing childcare
He needs a federal waiver to expand that.
He's talking about providing child care for people on welfare, try and get them a benefit to free them up to go get a job.
Right. And
Alberta,
you just reported this
Alberta
today,
put
Alberta
out
Darling.
Last night saying she wants to see a sliding scale for welfare. So instead of having there be a drop off, a cliff, where you make this many dollars and you lose everything, that you kind of gradually step down. So you can kind of keep getting benefits to help you as you work your way up the ladder. The idea being there shouldn't be a disincentive that if you get a job, a chance for a raise, 50 cents an hour, whatever it might be, you don't say no, because if I say yes to that, then I lose A, B, and C, and it causes me actually lose money in the end.
Yeah, so. And Speaker Voss, in his thank you for electing me speakers speech, he really made, he came up with these numbers. Every year, these are averages, Wisconsin is going to need 100,000 new workers. Mm-hmm. We're graduating our high schools 58,000 a year. So there's this gap, this shortfall. So he's beginning to stake out some of his own turf on this workforce issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
He really is. Okay. Next subject. Well, the filing deadline for the April 4 elections. Mm-hmm. Supreme Court Justice Annette Ziegler will be the first uncontested, unchallenged justice in 11 years. Why?
Multiple reasons. On the one hand, there is the question of, well, one, how do you beat an incumbent? It's happened twice that I know of in the last, what, 60 years? So Lewis Butler, and then go back to the 1960s, I think maybe 67, where a justice who wrote the decision or was part of the decision to allow the Braves to leave Milwaukee,
yes,
he lost.
Yep.
Other than that, it's hard to find a justice who loses or even gets it closer. In Prosser, his race was close not because of necessarily him, but because of it was a de facto referendum on Act 10 at the time. You know, unprecedented attention and money at the time of that race. So you have the challenge of beating an incumbent. Next, you have the challenge of money and infrastructure. Was it there for a race? You then have to look at the environment in which people are looking to run in. We had a year of 2016 where we had a big primary for president in the spring, Supreme Court race, Senate race, presidential race went through the summer and fall.
Yeah.
It sucked up all the oxygen. So it's hard for anybody, if you were going to run, to kind of get some attention to raise money to build a foundation to go. There's this kind of one thought out there that, oh, progressives are licking their wounds over Trump winning Wisconsin. That's off base, though, from when I talk to people, because if you were serious about running for Supreme Court right now, you should have been in the summer laying a foundation, talking to people, getting an organization built that you could launch, you know, in the fall. So you should have been at work even before, you know, Trump won Wisconsin and the losses that they suffered. Then you go on to things like, okay, what would this race have meant? Well, not for the majority, because Rebecca Bradley won re-election last spring. It's going to be 5-2. Even if you beat Ziegler, it'd be 4-3. You'd have to win Gableman to get flip it and then defend Abramson's seat 19. Yeah. It's a much more difficult terrain than it would have been had Bradley been beaten this past spring. You mix all these dynamics together and you get part of what's happening. Plus, too, don't diminish that Ziegler has been fairly well-liked. She raised $200,000 in less than, like, I think, the second half of June as a sign that she's going to be aggressive. And she had people like Corey Nettles, who was in Democrat Governor Jim Doyle's administration, Kim Murata, Mark Murata's wife, who was Doyle's DOA, so Democrats backing her as well. So don't diminish that she was, you know, liked and respected by a lot of people and, you know, made her a formal opponent.
She has also not been as high profile as the Chief Justice, as Justice Gableman, as Justice Prosser. So, yes, she's been a part of the conservative bloc, but she really hasn't laid down any major emotional or controversial markers.
And if you're going to run against her, what would the argument be? So there's this, the quote-unquote dysfunction of the court we've dealt with on and off for the last however many years, five, six at this point, or maybe beyond that. But what else beyond that? What do you peg on her? That also is another barrier, you know. And I do think that I get the impression that progressives are looking more at next year and Gableman. For whatever reason, he's more vulnerable than Ziegler was.
Okay, but let's look at next year. If I am a moderate to liberal and I write campaign finance checks, I know that I'm going to be asked to support Senator Baldwin, the Democratic nominee for governor, and anybody who may take on Justice Gableman. So maybe this is a time, having just written checks in the election year last year, that I'm going to sit this one out financially.
The money and infrastructure piece of it, absolutely.
Okay, but now let's talk about the April 4 other statewide election for superintendent of public instruction. Tony Evers has two opponents. The former Dodgeville administrator who's just been hired as a consultant backed by the Dodgeville district, John Humphreys, and the retired Beloit superintendent, Lowell Holtz. Some of these are backed by the conservatives, right? Which ones?
Well, I mean, the conservatives are, would like to see an alternative to Evers. That's clear. But which one of these two challengers will emerge as the one they get behind? That's a good question. I get the impression a little bit that some groups may hang back and kind of watch and see who emerges and then get behind that person after the election. Now, unless one emerges as the clear, stronger alternative, so maybe it'll be a quiet primary and then things would ramp up, you know, in April. Some interesting things about this race, though, are that, one, there's no Supreme Court race anymore on top of the ballot, right? So what's going to drive turnout in a DPI race? Let's be honest. Spring elections, even Supreme Court races, are not high profile. Put 2011 aside because of Act 10. Put 16 aside because of the presidential primaries. Mm-hmm. Usually, if you get a million people, you're lucky. You know what? 1.1, something like that. So they're very low turnout races. You have one layer taken off. Are there big county executive races out there, big mayoral races? I mean, it's not like Tom Barrett's not up this spring. Chris Abele's not up this spring. So you're not seeing big high probabilities of drive turnout. So it could be a low turnout rate, even lower than usual. Then, so Republicans, if the state GOP has a great turnout game, we know that now. They've won elections, you know, they've proven themselves. Will they care to fire up that machine, the coalition, to win DPI superintendent? Will they care?
Isn't it also possible that the DPI superintendent election could be a referendum on choice?
Sure.
Choice has now grown to the point where the general fund dollars for choice is $247 million for 1 year.
And so the choice groups could get involved if they see a path to beating Evers. The flip side is this: what we know that the public employee unions in Wisconsin have been decimated financially by Act 10, right? So will the teachers unions, will the NEA and those folks, national groups, pour money in to try and keep one of the last kind of like beachheads for Democrats or progressives in Wisconsin and a statewide elected official?
Yeah, and we took a week off to be with our families. Mm-hmm. So on December 27th, I was surprised to be working when the announcement came that Transportation Secretary Mark Gottlieb was leaving mm-hmm. office and being replaced by Dave Ross, the Secretary of the Department of Safety and Professional Services. That announcement came 3 weeks exactly after that 8-hour public hearing, yes. Three of which was dominated by Mr. Gottlieb's testimony. Why is he no longer the WSDOT secretary?
The perception has been that Gottlieb is kind of a Tommy Thompson infrastructure type Republican. What I mean by that is that they believe in investing in infrastructure. They like building roads. They like building projects. They like, you know, doing those things. That stance doesn't really jive right now with Governor Walker's position of no revenue uppers for transportation, barring an offsetting tax cut somewhere else. So they've kind of had sometimes an uneasy alliance on this, but that hearing last month, it was clear that Gottlieb was carrying out the message that the governor's administration wanted him to, but his heart wasn't in it. And so either you have people who think that the administration wasn't happy with how Gottlieb carried it out, or people think that Gottlieb said, you know what, this is just not working out anymore. You know, either way, it was clear that they weren't on the same page when it came to transportation funding, and how to go forward, and that this, you know, just wasn't working anymore.
I think Gottlieb was a victim of his own experience because he's a civil engineer. Mm-hmm. So when he was asked by members of the Assembly Transportation Committee, if we put these Southeast Wisconsin mega projects on hold, when will they be completed? 70 years from now. If we don't do any major planning, when's the next time we could plan major expansion of highways? 46 years. Mm-hmm. So I think that showed his experience as a civil engineer, and I think he paid dearly for it.
So that's interesting. Is Dave Ross is coming in. Dave Ross does not have the background that Mark Gottlieb has in terms of being a civil engineer. He's a mayor of Superior
now. For
Superior,
8 years.
Superior does have to deal with, you know, it's a port city, you know, rail, so he's got some experience with that. But in their press release announcing his appointment, it noted he'd been in the upholstery business for 20 years.
That's
the same level of experience.
Okay.
But what Ross has got going for him, no relation, by the way, never even been to Superior. What he's got going for him is that he has been a good soldier in the Walker administration. Like,
yes.
He's run his agency. It's a smaller agency. Run the way the governor wanted. Carried out the message. And now he's going to move up to a bigger agency and run it. Now, next question is, what do they do to bring people in to help him out? Do they have any more changes at DOT to kind of bring people who can fill in the gaps of the Ross resume?
Because his deputy has applied for the Department of Veterans Affairs. Excuse me.
More changes going on? What? Watch that the next couple of weeks, see if any more changes coming up with DOT.
Well, I just want to put some context on what you said. Right now, Secretary Ross is running an agency that has a budget of $51 million a year with 245 employees.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to the Department of Transportation, I just looked it up from the Fiscal Bureau, a budget of $3 billion a year with 3,495 FTEs. So, yes, Mr. Ross's experience, he serves the governor as a loyal cabinet secretary at this level, but whoa.
So again,
WSDOT.
That's the who they surround him with to help fill in those gaps and give him support system to succeed. And, you know, it's interesting. He's going to have to now go for finance sometime in March or April when they have those public hearings in the budget.
Sure, on
and
agency.
Defend that thing up and down. Is he how prepared will he be to talk about the budget inside and out by then, especially when it's created by his predecessor?
Yeah. So okay. Time for your stock picks.
Rising. So Katrina Shanklin, she
former assistant Democratic
minority leader.
Leader
decided not to run for minority leader again after the election in November. Landed nicely on finance over the holidays. Barker made the announcement late on Friday afternoon last week. What's interesting here is that after the November election, there are lots of Democrats who are unhappy about what happened in the assembly. They lost a seat, didn't pick anybody up. All kinds of chatter about who's going to challenge Peter, would anybody go after him? And Chris Taylor and Gordon Hinds were both on finance last session. One's not coming back, Chris Taylor. The perception is that Taylor may not have played her hand as well in those talks with Peter as Hinds did. That Hinds and Gordon or Hinds and Barker reached some kind of a agreement or, you know, understanding that kept him on.
Yeah.
And that with wanting to find a good place for Shanklin to land, they said, okay, Peter said, okay, Chris, we're going to find something else for you to do and put a spot for her. Also, it represents, you know, Barker is very much about geographic and gender balance. You have one male, one female, one from Oshkosh, one from Stevens Point. He's from Kenosha, you know, trying to balance out where these folks are from. Diane Hasselbein, the new assistant, is from Middleton. So you're kind of creating a balance with the leadership structure in the Assembly Democratic Caucus.
Yeah, but there's been some chatter about Taylor considering running for governor. Was that a factor, you think, in why she's no longer on finance?
Her name's been floated for that, for attorney general. So, I mean, I get the impression that she and Barker have clashed before. So, you know, it's kind of a matter of what's best for, in Peter's mind, for the team.
Okay, mixed.
So Jill Stein, going to get some money back, looks like.
Yeah, she was quoted 3.5. She sent a check for 3.5, and it's coming in at 1.8.
Yeah, well, remember, quoted 3.5, went up to 3.9 because they said we mixed a couple numbers up. Now it's down roughly 1.8 and change, but I think one county's left out. We'll get it back
Brown
next
County
week.
Brown County estimate next week.
Either way, looking at a bunch of money coming back. So that's a good thing. And then she has a news conference on Tuesday, Capitol Stats, which barely anybody attends. And says, we're going to put some money into like this new voter
record.
Because
there was a lot of stuff happening Tuesday inside the building.
Yeah, it was a little
cold. Was a 4 o'clock press conference.
A little cold and all that kind of stuff. But still.
Wisconsin, I was there. Go ahead.
A little cold, but the impression is, well, maybe her 15 minutes are kind of up in Wisconsin right now. You know, that there's just not the, they use this, the Green Party kind of uses this as a good fundraising, you know, spread the message, got a lot of public publicity, but now the attention's turned elsewhere. And so I don't know that the Count My Vote, whatever she calls, is going to be a big influence in Wisconsin politics going forward.
Trivia. In 2012, her running mate was from Madison. Do you remember who it was?
Drawing a blank.
Okay.
I remember David Hobbs was the candidate in 08. I remember him.
Hey, way to go. Falling.
The DNR. So you've got this kind of a couple things going on. One, you know, there's this constant tension about climate change with Republicans and the conservative base and the scientific community, right? So the DNR quietly scrubs this language about climate change.
Quietly.
From the website. And, you know, on the one hand, you get the scientific community and like the media going, what's going on? Why is this happening? And the DNR saying, well, there's a debate. Well, there is a debate in the public, but not with the scientific community saying overwhelmingly there's a human influence on this. You've got that kind of negative thing going on. Then you have the report this week saying, okay, if we wanted to raise, like, you know, fix some budget issues, you'd raise $5 million by raising fees. Now, how would you raise fees? Hunters, anglers, people using the parks. So you're talking about raising fees, possibly, at a time when hunting and fishing and preservation is going down. So how do you make that all work? And so, it's a little bit of a growing pain.
And meanwhile, you have this issue about whether you should split DNR. Mm-hmm. And one should be the environmental agency, the watchdog, so to speak, and the other would take care of the hook and gun crowd.
Very good. And that's not a new idea. John Gard, I think, in 2001, it was a Warner.
You're right.
Warner 3, somewhere, 2001, I think it was, proposed that with then-Governor McCallum. Back, didn't do it in the budget in the end, but you know, it's been around for a while, so it's continued growing pains, trying to revamp itself here, where it's going to go next.
Okay, and next week we will talk about the governor's state of the state. Boy, a lot going on. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for this week.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. Sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. It's how we get there.